Good morning. So, we're very happy this morning to have as our speaker, longtime student here and senior student, Richard Haveley. Richard is has been practicing here since 1973. He's been Chuzoa head student, member of the senior student group, and has received lay recognition from Sojin Roshi. He is a father, a husband, now becoming an increasingly accomplished woodworker. He's led numerous groups here and regularly has a Dharma group that meets weekly?
Twice a month, yes.
So anyway, look forward to hearing what you have to share with us.
Thank you, Alan. Good morning. Fine morning. Sunny, and it's going to get up to 80 degrees or something even hotter today. So enjoy it while it lasts. So I'm here because I love Zazen, and Zazen loves me. And I'm going to talk about how Zazen gives us the love and the comfort and the security to face very difficult parts of ourselves and those parts that we've been avoiding for much of our lives. The hateful parts, the scary, lonely parts. And I think this morning we had the Bodhisattva ceremony where we talk about our tangled and twisted karma. And how do we get to know that tangled and twisted karma is some of the, benefits of Zazen. As you heard, I lead a Dharma group here at the Zen Center on Monday evenings, every other Monday evening or thereabouts. And we are reading and chewing on a book called Transformation at the Base by Thich Nhat Hanh. It's a book about consciousness, about the a Buddhist view of consciousness. And some of you may not know, but these consciousness, there are eight of them. And the first five are our sense consciousnesses, our eyes, smell, touch, and so on. The sixth is the mind consciousness. The seventh is manas, or sometimes thought of as our ego. And the eighth is the storehouse consciousness. And these consciousnesses can see the world accurately or inaccurately, the five sense consciousnesses can see what is really there, or not. As a student artist, I can tell you that it's really hard to see what's really there. Because we have this preconceived idea of say, what a flower is. I was drawing a blackberry, an unripe blackberry, and you know, I think of a blackberry as got these tiny little round individual seed pods, as it were, as part of that come together and make the entire berry. But when you really look at it, those little guys are not round. They're kind of like connected straight lines and little curves here and there and that sort of thing. So if you don't really look at it, you're not seeing what's there. The sixth conscious, the mind consciousness, has the opportunity to both see things truly or not. But when you get to the seventh, the manas, or the ego, and to the eighth, the store consciousness, then you're hopeless. What comes up from there is really going to be a false image. Good example of that would be if I say to you, bomb blonde shell, what do you see? Something comes up.
A cartoon,
yeah. Or a big, huge bomb that's painted white or creamy color, blonde color. Or maybe Marilyn Monroe or something like that. But the idea is that that image, whatever it is an image that's coming from your mind. It's not an image of what it is I'm saying. The manas, which is basically borrows all of its ideas and images from the store conscious, has got the same problem. It's dependent on what's already there in the mind. And whatever was already there in the mind is only a model of what's going on in the actual world around us, as we know from blackberries. Okay, so that means we're kind of doomed in a sense. We're really pre-programmed to be prejudiced, to see things from the viewpoint of the way we see them, the way we think we see them, and not the way they really are. I mean, years ago, I was at a conference, and I was listening to this talk, and the speaker said something, and I thought he said one thing. And I checked with a friend of mine, and actually the speaker said the total opposite of what it is I thought he said. It was amazing. At some point or other, I just tuned out of what the speaker was saying, and I replaced it with what I wanted to hear in my mind. Totally, totally amazing. Kind of scary, too, you know, when you think about it. So another example, an idea. You know, we're told that we should walk in another person's shoes for a mile, moccasin shoes, tennis shoes, whatever, for a mile. And that's okay because it may give you their viewpoint, but even so, you're still not going to get the accurate viewpoint. You're going to get their viewpoint, you're going to have your viewpoint, and there's going to be lots of other viewpoints going on there, affecting us. So the eighth conscious is the store conscious, and that's because it stores what Thich Nhat Hanh calls seeds. Seeds, and I'll read to you what seeds are out of the book. Thich Nhat Hanh starts this book with 50 verses that are translated, I think, from one of Vietnam's great Zen teachers of historical time. And this is translated from that. I'm going to read you the first four of the 50, talking about store consciousness. Mind is a field in which every kind of seed is sown. The mind field can also be called all the seeds. In us are infinite variety of seeds, seeds of samsara, nirvana, delusion, and enlightenment, seeds of suffering and happiness, seeds of perception, names, and words. Seeds that manifest as body and mind, as realms of being, stages and worlds, all are stored in our consciousness. That's why it's called store. Some seeds are innate, handed down by our ancestors. Some are sown while we were still in the womb. Others were sown while we were children. I would go on to say, and others are being sown as we speak right now, as adults. We're constantly, things are being planted in our store conscious. Seeds is an interesting analogy of the way he describes them, because then he goes on to talk about there are wholesome seeds and unwholesome seeds. It's a good example of a seed is anger. Right? You're being cut off by the... you're driving in traffic and you're cut off by someone and you get angry. Right? There's a seed of anger that's there sitting in you, and it arises. So you have the opportunity now of doing several things, but one of them you can do is you can water that seed and let it flourish in you and exacerbate the anger, keep it going, continue raging at the person who cut you off. Or you can put a hot lamp on that seed, dry it out, and let it recede back into the store conscious. It's not going to go away. It's going to recede back into the store conscious. You might do that by saying, well, the guy's in a hurry, or, well, this happened to me lots of times before, and if I get angry, it's just going to make me feel bad, so I'm not going to do that sort of thing. And there's lots of ways to handle these watering processes that are going on. That's another kind of seed. Attraction, in my case, as a man, I'm attracted to a certain kind of woman. And if you want to know who that woman is, you just have to look at pictures of my wife when she was 20 years old, and you'll see that's the person. And each of us has attractants. I'm sure that at our ages, we probably are pretty familiar with the kind of person that we're attracted to and the kind of person that we're not attracted to. So there's another seed, something going on that's there that arises. I heard this story a few weeks ago about some studies that they were doing with infants, children. They had a bowl of cereal, one kind of bowl of cereal here, and one bowl, and another bowl of cereal over there. And they had the infant sitting there, and then they had a puppet. And they had a puppet that had a big smiley face, and a puppet that had a frown and wasn't so happy. And they got this baby to associate the happy puppet with the one kind of cereal, and the sad puppet with the other kind of cereal. And later on, they came back, and that baby preferred the cereal that was associated with the happy puppet. This is at, you know, a very, this is within months of the child's birth. Already forming preferences, already establishing pleasure and pain, suffering, and ideas about how the world really is. So this stuff goes back a long, long way, from almost the very beginning, probably in our womb. I know my daughter, my first daughter, was five months. My wife was 5 months pregnant with my daughter, and we went to a rock concert in New York City. And my wife said, she was just rolling and rocking. All that loud music. And she still likes loud music. So, yeah, so they're there. And we're stuck with them. You know, that's just our human condition. We are just, here we are. We're just stuck with them. So... I asked Merrill Sojin a few months ago about how we handle these seeds when they come up, and he said a thought comes up and it's an unwholesome thought, and I said, how do you handle that? And he says, well, think about something else, take your mind and go somewhere else with it, kind of like what I was talking about with the anger, just take it somewhere else and do something with it. So I've been practicing that myself. When I recognize that an unwholesome thought, idea, feeling comes up, I say, no, this is not what I want to do. This is not what I want to think about. Very often I just stop thinking about it. I find that pretty good. But it does require mindfulness. And Thich Nhat Hanh goes on to talk... when mindfulness is practiced, our mind consciousness has the capacity to be wholesome. In moments of forgetfulness, it has the capacity to be unwholesome. And it can also be indeterminate, either wholesome nor unwholesome. So mindfulness now is pretty important. And that's where we come to the Zazen, of course, is mindfulness. Well, Suzuki Roshi has some comments about mindfulness. And I'm reading out of the Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, page 115 in my old copy. I think it's on some other page in the newer copies that we have. It's a chapter out of a section entitled Readiness, Mindfulness. The importance of things in our understanding is to have a smooth, free-thinking way of observing. We have to think and to observe things without stagnation. We should accept things as they are without difficulty. Our mind should be soft and open enough to understand things as they are. That sentence really captured me when I was reading it. Our mind should be soft and open enough to understand things as they are. So, soft zazen. I was thinking, now what is soft zazen? That's interesting. He goes on to say, when our thinking is soft, it is called imperturbable thinking. The kind of thinking that is always stable. It is called mindfulness. Thinking, which is divided in many ways, is not true thinking. Concentration should be present in our thinking. This is mindfulness. Whether you have an object or not, your mind should be stable and your mind should not be divided. This is Zazen. So, I ask myself the question, what is soft zazen? Dogen Zenji, in his in his essay on the rules for Zazen, Zazen-ji, Zazen is not learning to do concentration. It is the Dharma gate of great ease and joy. It is undefiled practice enlightenment. So now we have ease and joy, Zazen. We have soft Zazen and ease and joy, Zazen.
That's great.
So I'm wondering what these are and how we go about doing them. I've often thought, and I know there's a woman who has been practicing here for many years, Rebecca Maino, who talks about Zazen as mother. We settle into Zazen and we breathe and we sit in our posture and we just go up and down with our breathing, in and out with our breathing, and pretty soon we experience some of this joy and ease that Dogen is talking about, and some of the softness. We're just letting go of those things which are grabbing hold of us. Now, when I used to work as a computer programmer, I would spend 8 hours a day really concentrating on computer programs, or meetings with people, or various other issues going on in my life. And I would come to Zazen in the evening, and my brain would still be programming. It's amazing how it just kept programming. Just kept thinking about all those issues and things like that were going on. And as I settled into the Zazen, pretty soon that programming activity and those thinking and the worrying about what was going on and that sort of thing would start falling away. And I could just let go of it. So I think that's some of the softness and the ease and joy what they're talking about here. So I wrote here, there's a deep understanding of giving up needing things and wanting things and honors and relationships, giving that up and replacing it with love for ourself, for our self-respect. Not a love for our ego or our aggrandizement, but for the self that's even deeper in our persons. Some people would call that Buddha nature, our love for our true nature, for our true self. When we can sit Zazen, that can kind of come up, and we can start trusting that in our lives. And when something scary comes up, or something that we wanted to avoid for a long time because it puts us in a bad light, that thing that I did 2 years ago to that person, that's a terrible thing to do. So I've been avoiding that thought for 2 years because you know that you don't want to think it, because you don't want to see yourself as being a bad person. When you have love of self, understanding that there really is something there that is true and wonderful, you can start facing that bad behavior and maybe making amends and maybe not, but depending upon where it goes, but at least you can actually see it, and that's really good. Okay. We become honest with ourselves. And this releases a lot of energy. You know, when you have to spend a lot of time thinking of moving yourself or not allowing yourself to think things, it takes a lot of energy to do that. A lot of energy avoiding stuff that's going on in your mind. But when you can start facing that and start seeing it, then that releases a whole lot of energy. I imagine you probably, many of you have witnessed that as an example. In the past, a lot of energy that we previously used to keep ourselves safe and hidden, and this also increases our compassion for other people. Not only does it free ourselves, but it also frees other people around us. They see that we're becoming honest, and they see that we can. We're not going to lash out and strike back at them for maybe past transgressions. Make them look foolish. There's no need for that, because the energy of making someone look foolish comes from wanting to boost yourself up. But if you have loved yourself, you've identified this self that loves you and that you love, you don't need to do that anymore. Okay, so you can see that I love Zazen, and Zazen loves me in that sense. I also want to talk about a little bit about Zazen as a rehearsal for death. So this came up in a Dharma group, actually, that conversation that one of the members of the Dharma group had a friend's child die within hours of being born. It's a very sad situation. And so we started talking about death and what it was and whatnot. And talking about Zazen as, I think of it as maybe not death, but rehearsal for death is what I wrote down here. I'm not sure that's even a rehearsal for death. What I wrote is, we can let go of needing to have, to cling, and can let go of much, perhaps everything. Okay, so when we're sitting Zazen, and these thoughts and feelings and needs for love, needs for having stuff, needs for food, there's a lot of needs that are arising in us as we sit Zazen. And as we sit Zazen, those needs start falling away. So when all those needs start falling away, then what's left is kind of the true self. This Buddha mind, Buddha energy, Buddha nature, flavor of things. That doesn't ask for anything. Doesn't require us to perform or behave or act or whatever, which is really nice, very comfortable. And I had a thought which just went away. When I think of death, of course, I think of the cessation of things. But you know, there's a lot of different ideas about death and what it is. Cultures have created ideas about death and life after death and what it will entail. Christian, I guess, has their view, and some schools of Buddhism have views about it. When I start hearing about those different views, frankly, my mind goes kind of blank. I get kind of gaga, and I can't really follow the logic that people are using. So I don't really understand all the different issues that the various cultures and schools and whatnot and thoughts have about death. But I've often thought that let's say Aristotle, no, Socrates talked about death. Well, maybe it's just like going to sleep. Maybe. And if it is kind of like going to sleep, then there's a sort of a sensation of it. And Zazen, in a sense, is not going to sleep, certainly, although I've done plenty of sleeping in Zazen. But there's kind of an ending of all desires and all needs. And so the fear of it, the fear of dying, the fear of cessation, I've experienced. I was sitting Zazen, actually, down way over there in the corner during one Sesshin many years ago. Actually, Blanche Hartman was leading the Sesshin here back, gosh, when was it? It must have been the mid-80s. And so the last period of the 5 day, and I was breathing, and I just kept my breath just kept exhaling and exhaling, and suddenly I got very scared, because I said, "What if I never take another breath? What if I never inhale from this exhale?" It scared me. And so I, of course, took a breath. But it did scare me. So, oh, I'm going to die. And later on, I was sitting at home, and the same thing happened to me. And except there, my thought was, okay, I'll just go ahead and die. And then I took another breath, and there it was. So, so something happened there. Of course, I'm still afraid to die. You know, we come from a long line, a very long line of survivors. Watching a program on Darwin last night, and you know, way back in when we were fishies and even earlier, every one of our ancestors was someone or some entity who survived. and we've inherited all that energy to survive. And I know that that's part of our karma, part of our human condition, that we and of course every other animal's condition too. But as humans, we really suffer for it because we want to avoid death and run away from it. And we associate so many things with death. For example, being insulted by someone, not very nice, not very pretty. But I've always seen that as kind of a reason we don't like it, is because of the fact that someone insulting us means they don't like us, which increases our chance of dying. That we're not going to be part of the community. We're not going to be safe. So we're afraid of that. So much of our life is run by the fear of death. Our desire to acquire stuff, right? Money, things like that. It kind of comes back to that energy that we have as human beings, as living human beings that we inherited. That's true. That we can't deny, that we want to live. Period. There's no doubt about it whatsoever. And sometimes we're willing to sacrifice other people for our desire to live. Okay. So, I'm going to close by giving you a warning. And that is that I've talked a lot about the benefits of Zazen and how wonderful it is. And so you can sit there and say, okay, I'm going to go sit Zazen and I'm going to fall in love, or I'm going to go sit in Zazen and I'm going to learn how not to be afraid of death, or I'm going to go try to do something in Zazen. And we've been warned by our teachers for many eons that that's not the thing we should be doing. We shouldn't be trying. There's a story about a Zen teacher who sees a student, I guess a very accomplished student, sitting Zazen, and the teacher goes over and says, "What are you doing?" And the student says, "Well, I'm trying to become Buddha." And the teacher says, "Hmm." And he goes away and comes back with a tile that has come out of the kiln, and he starts polishing it. And the student says, curious, "What are you doing?" The teacher says, "Well, I'm polishing this tile to make a mirror of it." The student said, "Well, you can't make a mirror out of a tile." And the teacher said, "Well, you can't become a Buddha by sitting Zazen." So that's an interesting story. You know, you can't get love by sitting Zazen. You can't get learning about death by sitting Zazen. You can't get something by sitting Zazen. Except maybe knees that don't work quite as well as they used to. So you know, I talked about all this good stuff about what Zazen is, and I'm just saying, no, wait a minute. Don't sit down and say, okay, I'm gonna get this stuff that he's been talking about, because it ain't gonna work for you. What I thought about this, and what I like to do, is to say, okay, I'm gonna sit down and I'm going to do what my teachers have told me to do when it comes to Zazen, which is basically sit up straight. As straight as I can, and concentrate on my breathing, let my breath fall down into my hara, and when my thoughts stray away from just following my breaths or counting my breaths or whatever, then when I remember that, and I realize that that's what's happening, then I come back to that counting, that following of breaths, and just being there. And that is enough to do in Zazen. And all this other stuff I've talked about, well, let's see. I know Mel's talked about he can't promise this stuff. So I suppose I shouldn't say I can promise it. But since I've been practicing since 1973, I have found that sometimes it happens. Sometimes. And quite early, I think about the third or fourth time I sat Zazen, I was having a real conflict with my sister. And suddenly I realized that just all melted away. It wasn't there anymore. Just, how come? It wasn't there. So that was really nice. That was really good. Well, that's all I have. And I would like to have some questions, but I'd love to have a little dialogue and discuss and whatnot. Anybody have a question?
Yeah. Something stuck in my mind when you said you can't get love with Zazen. And I assume you're talking about other people loving you, or you're talking about you loving other people. And I'm curious because I think that sometimes sitting in Zazen deepens my sense of compassion.
Mm-hmm.
And I get the idea that I can't go sit Zazen seeking that feeling of compassion, but I'm wondering if I can fully experience the compassion without sitting.
Well, certainly I encourage you to continue sitting, if that's what you're debating, and I don't think it is. I encourage you to continue sitting. But I don't think that's
going on strike.
I didn't think you were thinking about going on strike. But I think what you're saying is exactly what I'm saying. I think you're echoing basically that Zazen allows that compassion to arise, and more Zazen, the more allowance there is.
If you seek it, you won't get. Is that what you're saying?
If you seek it, if you sit down and say, "Okay, I'm going to become compassionate now," the next 25 minutes from now, I'm going to be compassionate. Yeah, that's not going to work. Yeah, right. It's like. We have to sneak up on it. That's the way I thought about it. We sneak up on these things. And I think that well, for me, frankly, I started sitting Zazen because I thought it was going to be lead me to enlightenment, which I thought was going to be a cheap, legal high. Back in the 70s, we were into that sort of thing.
Without ruining your chromosomes, right?
Pardon?
Without ruining your chromosomes.
Without ruining my chromosomes and my lungs and, yes, the rest of it. So I did start Zazen with a certain amount of greed. And I think I think many of us, I can't really speak for you guys, but I even think that sometimes Zen teachers kind of encourage that. Sort of say, yeah, you know, come along, look at this wonderful stuff. And they turn around and they say, well, of course you're not going to get that wonderful stuff, but maybe you will. But then as we sit, and certainly this is true with me, as I sat, I realized that the sitting was wonderful. I suppose you could say it was like a high, but it wasn't really. The trouble with drugs and alcohol is that you get stoned and then you can't get unstoned. You know, you're just there for the hours and months and things like that that are there. But by releasing, letting go of that stuff and releasing the energy, that was wonderful. Yes?
Richard, thank you.
Actually, let me ask the woman behind you and then I'll call on you. How's that?
I just got back from LA yesterday because my mother died last week. And I found everybody here and I got the number. We were so busy making arrangements, I didn't even call. Anyway, but I was there for the last 2 weeks of her life, and it's like been like a thousand years. But I watched, she was always kind of snappy, she's sharp as a whip, and you know, kind of real hard on us when growing up. But anyway, when she was dying, she was so kind, and she, every word was just oh, that looks wonderful. And look at you, and the tattoos, and the nose ring. And my son said, my older son said, Mommy, she became a Buddha. It was her nature. She became her own the nature. I said, you know, I'm just truth. Yeah, truth. That one, that consciousness. I thought of that the whole time, and it was just amazing. And I dragged myself here because I've been up all night. Thank you for that talk.
My pleasure. It's wonderful. She sort of gave up all of her ideas about things and just accepted. Catherine.
I was very, I love the idea of soft zazen. And I was very intrigued by what feels like a contradiction that I often encounter as we talk Dharma. And it starts with Sojun's advice that the way to deal with a negative feeling is to just stop thinking about it. I've been arguing with him about this for about the last 20 years. So, but I was interested because I felt that at the moment that he said that, you accepted that. Oh, that's good advice. I'll try it. And one of the things he says to sort of defend that strategy is that for people who hang on to their strong feeling and sort of cultivate it and whip it up, because they kind of like the adrenaline and the intensity of it, that this is a good strategy because it's like, oh, I don't necessarily want to keep doing that, keep obsessing or persevering. And I also find that there are a realm of other strategies that for me have been way more fruitful. And when I just turn away from something, which I actually do very easily, it turns out to be repression. And I just stuff it, and I don't acknowledge that I'm angry, and then it leaks, you know. I mean, it's devastating for me to turn away from a negative feeling until I've done something that Kwang Roshi at Sonoma Mountain calls investigation. And I heard that also in your talk, that later when you were talking about Thich Nhat Hanh, learning to see what's really there. And I can almost remember the moment on the cushion at Sonoma Mountain when I got it that because I was beginning to learn to feel compassion for myself, I was able to allow myself to see a negative feeling, or I was able to acknowledge an anger or embrace a petty feeling and say, oh, that's me too. Oh, yes. Instead of, oh, no, I'm not that. I don't want to be there. So I just love it when we're talking about this, if we can get the balance there and remember that there are really two paths to work with the negative seed.
Right.
And understanding it and letting it, and being with it, sitting in it, feeling it, and until it transforms of its own, it is to me so much more productive just for me than trying to turn away from it.
Right. Yeah, definitely. We need to do that work And we say, with our mindfulness, we can say, this is not a thought or an action that I want to continue, which is good, because you don't want to exacerbate that karma, just keep rolling the ball along. And then with the love and caring that we have, we can start looking at that and saying, well, what's underneath that? What's happening? It's okay to have this feeling. It's okay to have this thought. And I love myself. And then pretty soon it starts melting away. Now,
well, to follow on this, I'm in general agreement with what Catherine was saying. I've just been reading something. So mindfulness is one of the factors of awakening. Investigation is another factor of awakening that goes hand in hand with mindfulness. And investigation in a kind of technical way, it's partly looking at where something comes from, but it's also looking at, oh, if I go down this road, is the effect going to be, is the effect of this train of thought is going to wind up in a station that's wholesome or a station that's unwholesome? And then as part of this process of discernment, is like, to really ask, do I have some choice about this?
And
do I have some agency because usually, and I was talking with someone last night, I was really driving back from a performance who felt really locked in their life, and she said, you know, the advice that she gets from her Buddhist friends to lighten up, that does not work, you know, and it pisses her off, you know. So we were talking about this. What does this mean to actually turn towards the conditions of your life with a sense of investigation, with a sense that you have some agency, not necessarily over the actual conditions, but over your response to it. And the other thing I would add is sometimes I can't do this myself. Mm-hmm. You know, if I'm caught in a way of thinking, I need to talk to somebody. I need to talk to a friend, not necessarily a teacher, somebody who understands, who is going to say, you know, well, what if you look at it this way or that way? And so to get, investigation is not something that one needs to do in a solitary fashion. You know, one can actually get help. And usually, as soon as you've taken the step of getting help, usually the stuckness is because you feel it's mine,
yeah.
You know, and I'm alone with it. And as soon as you break down that barrier and realize that, oh, we're all in it together, then it can start to loosen. That's why we sit together.
Right.
We don't. Our practice is not just like we don't sit in a hermetic system. We don't sit in a cave by ourselves. We actually sit around together when we can.
Any more questions? Any other questions? Yes.
Thank you, Richard, for talking. I think one of the things that, in line with the last two comments, one of the things that Zazen offers me, especially around those thoughts that keep reoccurring over and over again, even when you try to just let them go, is insight. In that, oftentimes I'm able to really, as part of my investigation, to sit into it and breathe into whatever's coming up, and then oftentimes it almost seems like magic, I guess, in certain ways, but insights do come forward, the softer my mind and body becomes, and that's just very gratifying.
There's a I guess I was thinking, I'm not sure that Alan said this. This is what I'm kind of interpreting it as being, that we get caught up in the problem. So it's such a strange knot, like the Gordian knot, right? It's this very complicated rope going in and around and over, and all those are our problems. And of course, so let's see, what's his name? Forgot his name. Comes by with a knife, with a sword.
Manjushri.
Alexander. Alexander the Great. Cut through. So, Zazen. Kind of, you know, like you were talking about. This is kind of what I interpret what you were saying. That we have this problem and it's going around, and sometimes we go talk to somebody and they cut through the knot for us, and sometimes we're sitting and the knot just seems to dissolve.
Well, one of the joys and also one of the difficulties of Zazen is that you can't go anywhere, and there's no book or TV show or, you know, whatever to avoid yourself, and so you sit with it.
That's why I like Sashin so much, because you're there, you know, Zazen period after Zazen period. Wonderful. Are there any more questions? I got the high sign for the ending, but if somebody has something they need to say. Thank you. Oh, wait a minute. One more. Al?
One of the things that I'm struggling with is usually to sit on a cushion on the floor and do what I... And I am wondering about the form itself as I move out of form that I've been used to for so many years, and how much how much of Zazen was dealing with pain, or, you know, to actually look at the pain and accept it and so forth. And I think that I'm at a stage where I'm really wondering what I need to do in this body to practice.
Yeah, I experienced that too. I hurt my knee in June, and I discovered I couldn't sit cross-legged for a while, and I had to sit in a chair or sit upright. I found it really hard. It took me a while to learn how to do it. There's a learning, I think, to learn how to sit in whatever posture that you settle into. So you're moving from cross-legged to a chair. That's a big change. I would suggest cutting off the back of a chair and just having like a stool. And have a low stool and put a zafu or a pillow on top of it. And then something like you've got the support for your legs. So you're not going to relax into the back. Some people with bad backs, I guess, have to do that. But the rest of us should have stools rather than chairs. I once asked the abbot of Tokufuji in Japan, Grace Shearson's teacher there in Japan, about pain. I asked him a question, is pain necessary for Zazen training? And I think his answer was yes. certainly they sit 50-minute periods there at that monastery, so pain is certainly part of their practice. And I think pain is wonderful because it really forces us to give up. And, you know, I live such a comfortable life. The pain of Zazen, of a Sesshin Zazen, is sometimes the only really serious struggle I have in my life. I know I don't like it. It's not fun, but there it is. Thank you.